Good to see everybody. So my plan this week was to go on to something new, and my plan was to at least, you know, for the next little while, to do Parsha. But then Lisa emailed me with a whole bunch of questions today, asking me to continue to talk about the questions. But she isn't here, so we don't have to listen. So what I thought we would do is we would do Parsha and one or two of the questions from the that were emailed, and we could continue with that strategy. We would do Parsha with a bit of questions. So so what should we do first? Parsha. Okay, great. So there were a couple ideas I wanted to do with you. So here's some sheets if you want to pass them around. The top relates to one of the questions. So the first is a piece that is in the that relates to a line in our parsha. And when Avram Avinu was buying Maris HaMachpelah, he goes to Ephron HaChiti, he goes to the Chitim, and he says to them, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. I am a ger and a toshav with you. Ger is a stranger, an alien, and a toshav is a resident or citizen. And the question is, what does this mean? Which one is it? Is it a ger? Is it a toshav? Is it both? So the Mefarshim do give a number of explanations, but I think the Rav very powerfully uses this pasuk to express an idea that I think many of us have in the society in which we live. And we'll just read what he says, because I think it expresses a tension that really so many of us experience. So, again on your sheets, the first patriarch, Abraham, introduced himself to the inhabitants of Canaan with the words, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. Are not these terms mutually exclusive? Avram's definition of his dual status, we believe, describes with profound accuracy the historical position of the Jew who resides in a predominantly non-Jewish society. He was the resident, like other inhabitants of Canaan, sharing with them a concern for the welfare of society, digging wells, and contributing to the progress of the country in loyalty to its government and institutions. Here, Avraham was clearly a fellow citizen, a patriot among compatriots, joining others in advancing the common welfare. However, there was another aspect, the spiritual, in which Avraham regarded himself as a stranger. His identification and solidarity with his fellow citizens in the secular realm did not imply his readiness to relinquish any aspect of his religious uniqueness. He was a different faith, and he was governed by perceptions, truths, and observances which set him apart from the larger faith community. In this regard, Avraham and his descendants would always remain strangers. Again, I'm just picking from this bigger piece. Like other people, a Jew has more than one identity. He's part of a larger family of mankind, but he also has a Jewish identity which separates him from others. Each identity imposes upon himself, upon him, particular responsibilities. As citizens of a pluralistic society, the Jew assumes social and political obligation to contribute to the general welfare and to combat such common dangers as famine, corruption, disease, and foreign enemies, freedom, dignity, and security of human life. These are concerns which transcend all boundaries of difference. The Jew, however, has another identity which he does not share with the rest of mankind, the covenant with God, which was established at Har Sinai 3,000 years ago. This identity involves responsibilities in the way of life which are uniquely Jewish and which inevitably set the Jew apart from non-Jews. It is particularistic rather than universalistic. There is an inevitable tension in trying to uphold these identities. So this is something that I imagine we all feel, and the truth of the matter is probably most of you feel it more than me, because I live a life in which I am fortunate enough to live and teach and learn in a yeshiva, and in my day-to-day life, for the most part, I am focused entirely on Bnei Yisrael. But most of you don't live such a life. Whatever your profession, doctor, nurse, or accountant, or lawyer, or teacher, or the like, for the most part, we're all involved in the broader world beyond the narrow Jewish world. And the question is, how do we identify with that world? How do we identify with our jobs? Are they just jobs, means to earn a livelihood, and that's it? Do we have a broader responsibility to society? What the Rav is arguing is yes. And that is reflected in this duality, these two terms that Avraham uses to describe his own predicament. Ger v'toshav. He is a toshav, and that demands of him to contribute to the broader society. We benefit from the broader society, and we have the responsibility to contribute. But at the same time, even as we do that, and even if our jobs were non-jobs, but our jobs take us to well beyond the Beis Medrash, the local, narrow Jewish community, we must always remember that we're apart, we're different, we're separate. And that will never change. We must remain that ger. And it's a difficult balance. It's a balance that perhaps is different. Plausible models. Some communities focus entirely on the ger aspect. And even as they're involved in the broader world, it's really perhaps a technical means to serve themselves and their own communities. Others, perhaps too much, focus on the responsibility to contribute to the broader society in such a way that they forget their own identity. And what the model of Avraham Avinu, the Rav, is arguing here is the need to do both, and how they're both positive. That's the first aura from the parsha I wanted to share. Number two relates to the nature of chesed. I was just reading this Ramban and struck by a fascinating aspect of Avraham. This is in Avraham's dealing with Ephron, an example of dealing with broader society, and we have really a lot to learn from the way in which Avraham deals with his neighbors in buying Ma'aretz HaMachpelah. And the whole story is really about the incredible kavod that Avraham gives to the Canaanim. He speaks to them with great respect. We see the lesson that again and again of Emor Me'at Ba'asei Harbei, Avraham, and really comparing that with Ephron. Ephron says a lot and does nothing. Avraham, even when offered to be given it as a gift, he says, I want to pay. Bekesef maleit nenuli. The paradigm of honesty, of dignity, of malchus almost, but in subtle ways as well. So, for example, he says, "Vayiten li," right? "Vayiten li esma rasa machmelah." The kesef male yitnenu li. So the Ramban notes that the lashon of "Vayiten li" or "Yitnenu li" is a lashon of matana. So Ramban says, "Sheachshov ota kematana." This is the next source. "In bekesef male ekachenu mimenu." If you let me buy it from you for full price, I'll consider it a gift. Balkain, lo hizkir, lashon mechira. That's why the pasuk doesn't say mechira, which is the word that you would have expected, right? Bekesef maleim kirenu li. Why does it say matana? V'chein, ochal bekesef tisbireni, umayim bekesef titein li. Shamayim hanitnim b'matana etein b'ham b'kasef oshu b'derech halashon l'hazkir kein b'mechibos. So I think the yesod is a very powerful yesod. Avram Avinu says, look, I'm going to pay full price, but I see it as a gift. Avram Avinu gives them the opportunity to feel good about themselves, even to feel like they're giving him a present, that they're doing him a favor. They're not really doing him a favor at all, just paying full price. But when Avraham, part of his chesed, part of his kindness, is that he does it in a way that the recipient of his kindness doesn't feel like they're getting a gift. On the contrary, they feel like they're doing him a favor. Sometimes when you meet real Balei Chesed, so they do you a favor and they somehow or another present it in such a way that they make it seem like you're doing them a favor. And you don't feel bad that they're doing you a favor because they convince you that you're doing them a favor. And that's the mark of someone who is an exceptional Baal Chesed. Because when you give to somebody, but you make them realize you're giving them a gift, so you make them feel small. I think our inclination, my inclination at least, is when I'm being nice to someone, I want them to know I'm being nice to them, so they'll be grateful to me, and I'll get credit. But that's not the best way to be nice, because in that case, I'm just making them feel bad. I'm making them feel like a recipient. The ideal form of niceness is to be nice to the person, but in a way that they don't feel like they're the recipient. If anything, that they feel like you're doing them a favor. Think, for example, of the best way of giving tzedakah, to help someone find a job. So that's important, not just because you give them the tools to be independent, but they don't feel indebted to you. They feel like they're working. And that's exactly what Avram does constantly. So yeah, the kesef malei, I'll pay full price. But then only I see this as a gift. Thank you for giving me this gift, for helping me. You see this as well in last week's parsha in a slightly different way, but a similar idea. Avram Avinu goes ahead, and when the guests come, so what does he say? He says, take a little water, right? All he says is, I'm going to give you bread and water. And what does he do? Of course, he prepares a whole lavish feast. But the point is, he does it in a way, he doesn't say, I'm going to prepare you a huge lavish feast. He doesn't. Just have a drink of water. Next thing they know, it's a feast. It's true. But again, first of all, You see the parallel in Amor Ma'at Vaseh Harbeh, but also in that when he does somebody a favor, he does it in a way that that they don't feel like they're recipients. Okay, so there are a couple more ideas in the parsha I wanted to share with you. But first we'll do some of the questions. We'll jump back and forth. So there were a couple of questions that were brought up. And maybe they relate to the parsha. We'll see. One I guess does relate to the parsha, which was, the question was, you know, our parsha talks all about the shidduchim, and the question is, what are the halachos of lashon hara, especially in the context of shidduchim? So this is a very broad question, a very tricky question, one which really we're not going to be able to cover exhaustively now. That would be a whole shiur in its own right, and even more. But we'll briefly discuss some of the issues. So, first of all, what are the general rules for lashon hara l'toelas? Right? When can you say lashon hara? And just before we even look at the rules, the conditions, it's important to keep the following in mind, which is, on the one hand, we know that the laws of lashon hara are very, very strict. And saying lashon hara when it's inappropriate is a very big aveira. Not just an aveira, but we all know it causes something. It could cause other people incredible harm or pain or the like. I know that we probably all like shudder at the notion that people might say lashon hara about ourselves. It's something that we really don't like. And of course, therefore, we have to be very, very careful about saying something bad about other people. and indeed it is a very severe avera. At the same time, there is a concern about the opposite. Lo samod al dam riacha. What does that mean? That means if you see somebody else that could possibly be harmed, and you can help them, and you don't help them, that too is a terrible avera. Don't stand idly on the blood of your friend. So, for example, if you know some information about one of the two parties that are going out, and if you don't tell one of the parties, let's say your friend, about the information you know about the other party, so you can be facilitating there or allowing them to be harmed. And failure to let them know, to warn them, could be lo samad al dam riacha. You're not doing a mitzvah by being careful about the laws of lashon hara. You're doing a terrible avera by standing by their blood. So the stakes oftentimes are very high. To say lashon hara when you're not allowed to is a big avera. Not to say lashon hara when you're supposed to is also a terrible avera. So these are tricky questions, and you have to ask a posek when they come up, because the laws and the details are complicated, and a lot of times we have very strong feelings. Recently, somebody asked me such a question, and I talked over the situation with them, but I said, you know, you should ask Rabbi Tversky. Why? Is there no Rabbi Tversky shir? So they went to ask Rabbi Tversky. And Rabbi Tversky said, this is a shaila of, I don't remember what his lashon was, shvichas damim or pikuach nefesh or something like that. You have to ask Rabbi Shechter. In other words, this isn't like a small question. Because here we had a question. The question was, he knew certain information. He didn't even know it firsthand, but he had credible secondhand information that possibly the other party didn't know that's relevant to the matter of marriage. She might have broken off their engagement. I don't think they were engaged yet, but they were getting close. Had she known this? But maybe she shouldn't say. Maybe things changed. Maybe he's different, right? That's really, you know, lives are at stake. And as I said, you can't just say, I'll be machmir and not say anything. That's also terribly wrong. But if you shouldn't say, or you say inappropriately, it's also terribly wrong. So these are questions that are very, very tricky. And have to be carefully assessed and the like. The Chafetz Chaim, I'll start with this, gives 7 rules for Lashon Hara L'Toelas. And I suppose when all 7 of these rules are clearly met, then usually it's not such a hard question. The tricky questions are when not all of them are at least clearly met. But what are his rules? So number one, this is at the top of the page, is you have to see it yourself and not hear from others. It has to be first-hand information, not second-hand information. Why? Because we all know that second-hand information isn't always true, isn't always reliable. Now again, sometimes this is tricky, because you don't only have second-hand information, but if you don't share that second-hand information, the other party might be harmed. So that's one of the cases where it's very tricky. Number 2, you need to examine the case carefully and to see if, in fact, the other party is going to be harmed. And it doesn't just appear that way. What do I mean to say? That things are not always as they appear. A lot of times you see something, and intuitively you interpret the events that you saw firsthand one way, but in fact, really something very different happened. And if you misinterpret the story, and then you convey that incorrect version, so that, again, you'll be harming somebody and unduly. So you have to remember that you see something, it's not always as it appears. And therefore, before conveying that information to a party that might be harmed, you have to be very careful. Now, again, that's what we're talking about when we discuss Lashon Hara L'Tועלת. Lashon Hara L'Tועלת means that if I don't convey this information, somebody else might be harmed. That's at least the typical case. Number three, you have to try to directly admonish the offender. Maybe he'll do tshuva. So what does that mean? I go ahead and, in a more simple case, I see somebody ripping off somebody else. See someone taking advantage of his clients or the like. So before I tell the clients or before I publicize it to the world, before I tell everybody, this guy's a crook, don't shop at his store, so I should directly confront him. Because perhaps the problem could be solved without publicly defaming him or without telling other people. Again, the questions are often tricky when you can't do this. In a lot of questions, as I said, let's say in the Shidduchim questions, you know that a person has a particular negative trait or has been involved in questionable behavior or the like. So it's not so simple to just tell the person. What if that's not going to help? What if it's something that's been in the past? It's not like an ongoing thing. In a case where he's ripping off his customers, so you can verify that he stopped, and simply by telling him if he stops, that will solve the problem. But oftentimes, this isn't feasible in this type of case. Number five, you need to be mechaven l'toelas. Now, this is also a tricky one. The truth is, in Shidduchim, this is usually the case. But let's say somebody goes ahead and rips you off. You shop at their store, they rip you off. So you want to go ahead and tell your friend who's also about to shop in that store. And all the other conditions are met. You know firsthand you were ripped off. You even tried admonishing the storekeeper. But you're a little happy to tell your friend because you're really upset at this storekeeper who's ripped you off. So then you may not tell your friend. Now this is also tricky because you also may not tell your friend. Like we said, that's l'sam et al damayacha. But you have to be mechavein l'shem shemayim. So what the Chafetz Chaim is saying is you have to overcome that desire you might have to get back at the guy who's harmed you, so as to make sure that you are able to be mechavein l'shem shemayim, in this case to protect your friend, and you can't have kavana to harm the person who's harmed you. Chafetz Chaim doesn't think the fact that right now you're upset at the guy is an excuse. You have to get over your feelings of resentment, maybe your desire to take revenge, so that you can help your friend. Number six, if there's another alternative without resorting to Lashon Hara, then you must do so. This sometimes requires ingenuity and creativity, but sometimes you could avoid the problem without saying Lashon Hara. There mustn't be any alternative. Sometimes not. Finally, number seven. If the result of your saying Lashon Hara will be undue harm to the person who you're telling about, then it's still prohibited. Now, this is also a very tricky one. Because sometimes a person does a small infraction. If I report it to other people, then he'll experience a lot of harm. He doesn't really deserve that much harm. So then you can't tell. But it's tricky because sometimes, like we said before, you have to tell. So these are the seven conditions. And like I said, when all conditions are met, so then it's very easy. What makes these questions very difficult is that sometimes not all the conditions can be met. But it's not always so simple as saying, well, if even one of these conditions are met, it's asur. Because like we said, sometimes a person might be harmed. And therefore, we're not going to go into the practical details of specific questions, but these are some of the things that need to be considered. Okay. Yes?
Kind of like the opposite, but sometimes like you get a call from like a boy's mother, and just in the line of questioning, you're like, something is weird in this family, and it's like very hard to be precise because you don't really know anything about that. You kind of also want to tell the girl, like, make sure you look into this family well.
Right. So, I think that nothing wrong, a lot of times with shidduchim, that's the best advice, which is saying something like, you know, make sure you do your homework or the like. And because then, you know, like in exactly in your case, you don't know that there's anything wrong, but you're suspicious. So you're giving them advice. You shouldn't give it in a way like, you know, that implies that by you're giving advice, you know something's wrong. That would be inappropriate. But advising them to go ahead and look into the matter, so that's an excellent way of doing things. Now, in general, when it comes to Lashon Hara L'Tu'alos, if this is something that they're going to find out anyway, then oftentimes there's no need to say anything. This will be discovered. In other words, we're really more concerned when it comes to situations where there's a fear that this particular issue, fault, defect, whatever it is, will not be discovered until it's too late, until a certain amount of damage has already been done, or maybe it's at a point of no return. But I think oftentimes giving that suggestion of doing their due diligence, when you know that, you know, if they do their due diligence, if they look into the matter, then they'll find it out, then, and you're just giving them advice to make sure they look carefully. So that's a very, if that's going to work, that's a good way to do it. Yeah.
What about if you personally find something out on a date and then you want to discuss to, like, get advice on something that you... worrying you?
I think you could almost always do that without there being a problem. Usually, oftentimes you can ask the question without mentioning the person's name or asking a person who doesn't know the person or the like. But,
I was learning about Lashon Hara with my husband, Chafetz Chaim, and we read, I guess we didn't get up to this yet, but we read that he said it's Lashon Hara to speak about, like, if someone used to be less from or not from.
Mm-hmm.
So we asked, my husband asked Rabbi Schechter if, like, everyone calls people, like, is he a flip out, is she a flip out? And he said, that's usher. So
sure.
Is that, like,
yeah,
Tu'alas then?
What's a Tu'alas? If it's relevant, well, you know,
how people grew up, I guess, when people call and ask you.
I think that, you know, certain types of things are to'eles, but they're not usually problematic. Like, if you know somebody is a Baal Tshuva, so first of all, anyway, that information is going to come out. But I don't, and it's not private information. Somebody hasn't gone out yet. If it's relevant, so then you could share that. I don't think that that's really a problem. Again, there are much more tricky things when there are aspects of a person's past that they're not proud about, that whether you reveal that information, and that's tricky because they might have moved past that, in which case it's no longer relevant. But how do you know? And when is it relevant and when isn't relevant? Those are the tricky questions. I think saying that somebody, you know, grew up unobservant. So what's wrong with that? That's an amazing thing that they became from. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's something to be proud of. That's extraordinary. So I don't think that's typically going to be an issue. The Gemara says a very interesting thing. This Gemara Yevamos, and the question is, what do you do with this Gemara exactly, which is a machlokas aposkim to some degree. The Gemara says the following. The Gemara says that there was, what's the halacha? If a person's mother is Jewish, but their father isn't Jewish, what's the halacha? So they're Jewish. So, in Talmudic times, might still be true, people of that situation were sometimes unfairly discriminated against. People don't want to marry someone whose father is not Jewish. Now, might not make any sense. If you're Jewish, you're Jewish. But, so the Gemara tells us about a person who was in that situation, and he was having a hard time getting married because nobody wanted to marry him because his father wasn't Jewish. So one of the Chachamim advised him to go to a different town where nobody knows him. Now, presumably, in that town, people would also be bothered by that situation. But what he's basically saying is, no, don't share that information. Now, you might have said that's wrong. Because, let's say, generally speaking, in Mecca Chumemkar, now we're not saying that marriage is the same as commercial transactions, but in certain ways, they're similar. In Mecca Chumemkar, if an item that I'm selling you is flawed, it's my responsibility to tell you. We don't say buyer beware. It's the seller's responsibility to inform the buyer of any defects in the product. Again, the parameters of that are somewhat complex at times, but that's the general rule. So, if there's a defect in me, because my father isn't Jewish, and I don't see it as a defect, but I know the other party will see it as a defect, so maybe it's my responsibility to tell the other party. And generally speaking, by the way, even if halachically it's not a responsibility, generally speaking, it's a good idea. Keeping secrets from your future spouse is not a good idea. It doesn't always make sense to share that type of information on the first date. Sometimes it's better to let them get to know you. And then at a certain point in time, after they see your great qualities, to let them know about a certain thing that they might have an issue with. But technically speaking, the Gemara indicates that here, he had no responsibility to tell this person. Even though, had they known, they would have objected. She would have minded. So the question is, why? Why? So, the basic answer, I think, is that he knew that this would not affect their marriage. He was still going to, he knew he was Jewish. He knew he was going to be a great husband, hopefully. And the fact that his father wasn't Jewish isn't going to prevent that. And the fact that other people thought so was just silly. And therefore, that type of defect, which isn't a defect, it's a perceived defect, but it isn't actually a defect, is not something that needs to be revealed. So that's what the Gemara seems to imply. Again, we're somewhat oversimplifying a complex matter. But this issue is a tricky issue when it comes to Shidduchim, because again, sometimes people are very machbit about certain things where it doesn't really make sense to be machbit about them, but you know they're machbit about it. So when should you tell? How should you tell? Is there a difference between voluntarily revealing the information or when you're asked? Yeah, there is a difference. Sometimes you have to volunteer the information because you know somebody's going to be harmed if they don't know this. Other times, you don't think they'll be harmed, so you don't have to volunteer the information, but if you're asked, you can't really lie. So, as I said, these are very, very tricky, tricky questions. Okay, the next question. Yes? Anything. A defect could be a medical defect, it could be a religious defect, it could be a halachic defect, it could be a personality defect. They're all, you know, I don't think the word defect is the right word to use. But yeah, they're all relevant. Why can't you tell the truth? In other words, in your example was they do sometimes watch TV, but they're looking to establish a home with no TV. But it's true. Maybe. You can't lie. If they watch TV, you can't say they don't watch TV. I would think. I think that's okay, especially if you're acting as a reference. In other words, You can't be deceptive, but you can present the information in a positive way. I think that's oftentimes the best way to do it. When possible, but it's tricky. Yeah. Again, these types of things, you have to be less concerned about things that they'll figure out anyway. And the cases where we're most worried is where there's a concern that it won't come out until it's too late. So something like that, which you know, if it's important, will come out very quickly, isn't a great secret or the like. So assuming you're answering the question truthfully and you're putting a positive spin on it, I don't think you would have to worry about the person being harmed, because they'll figure out the rest. Again, it's a specific question that needs a more specific answer, but I think generally speaking, that would be true.
I just don't think that
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, again, I think that's generally true. It's not so pashut, but generally speaking, yeah. Okay. So we'll do one more Q&A, and then we'll do a couple more parsha ideas. So one of the questions that was asked was buying drinks at Starbucks. So we had a full service, excuse the pun, a shiur on this, I think a year or two ago. 2 years ago, I guess. Probably more by now. Yeah, about 2 years ago. A little more, 2.5 years ago. So we're not going to review the whole topic there. We talked about the issues and the halachos and the like. But we'll briefly talk about some of the issues and how to handle them. And it is a tricky question. The ingredients in, let's say, plain coffee with milk are not an issue. Coffee doesn't need a hechsher. Water doesn't need a hechsher. Maybe not New York. Water doesn't generally need a hechsher. Sugar doesn't need a hechsher. Milk doesn't need a hechsher, assuming the person is mekel and chalav stam. So, in theory, the ingredients are okay. Now, obviously, sometimes some of the fancier coffees, like with flavorings and the like, the ingredients aren't necessarily okay, in which case it would be a problem. But where the basic ingredients are all okay, so then is it mutter? And this question isn't just relevant for Starbucks, it's relevant for buying coffee at McDonald's or the like. Let's say you're at a rest stop and the only place to get coffee is at McDonald's. So we'll leave out the issues in Mar Zion at the time for now. Though it's possible that getting coffee at McDonald's at a rest stop when that's all there is not in Mar Zion. Nobody reasonable would suspect that you're doing anything wrong or would suspect that McDonald's is kosher. They understand that at a rest stop you're just getting Coke or coffee or the like. But what about the kashrus issues? So like we said, the ingredients are okay. So are there any issues? So the issues at Starbucks are the following. It relates to dishwashing. What does that mean? That the kalim used to make the Starbucks coffee are washed together in either a dishwasher or a sink with all sorts of other full-fledged treif kalim. And especially at the full-service Starbucks stores, which are more problematic, they mamish have non-kosher things, let's say non-kosher sandwiches, which are like mamish, chazer, treif. And in the same dishwasher, they're washing together the treif dishes that are dirty when they go into the dishwasher, together with your kalim that are used to make your coffee. And to make matters worse, though in the dishwashers used at Starbucks, the first cycle of dishwashing has soap in it, but the second cycle does not, which means to say the rinse cycle is a very hot cycle, so it's sort of being in a very hot environment with hot water, treif, and your kalim used to be made to make your coffee. For that reason, there is makom lahachmir. And there are concerns. At the same time, there's also makom lahakel. Why? So again, that's what we talked about in this year last time. But there are a number of factors. Number one is that the first run of the dishwasher anyways was with soap, so it'd be pugum. The second one, you probably don't have mamashas left in it. And moreover, dishwashing works with the Eroi Kli. Usually it doesn't, it's not a direct, it's a, in dishwashers, typically, even though the water might be very hot, it's iwur shenifsek akiluach, which means to say that the spritzes of water are not connected to the kli rishon still at the time that they hit, which means that very likely they're not actually going to be able to treif up the kosher kalim. So that being the case, so probably you could argue that mikra din is mutter. Now, obviously, in our own homes, we would never do this. We would never put milchiks and fleishik dishes in the same dishwasher, which is what's happening here. Except it's worse; it's treif and kosher ones, because l'chatchila these are things that you're not allowed to do. But once they're done, it doesn't necessarily treif up your kalim. And here too, the kalim aren't necessarily treifed up. So, therefore, mikra din, the pashtus is its mutter. When we're dealing with the types of drinks that, when we're dealing with the type of drinks that the ingredients are not an issue, like coffee and milk and sugar and water. As I mentioned as well, the kiosk type stores tend to be less of an issue. because they're more coffee focused and they have less real treif stuff as well. So if you ask, look at the writings of the some of the contemporary kashrus organizations, both the CRC and the Star K give practical guidelines. The way the Star K gives it is a very funny way. It says something along the lines of, you know, when you're out of town and you could be makel to buy the following drinks, and when you're in town, then you shouldn't buy those drinks, but you could buy a shorter list of fewer drinks. So what are they talking about? If something's kosher, it's kosher in town and out of town. So I think what they're getting at is what I was saying, which is that there is makom lahakel, but it's not, there's makom lahachmir as well. So when you're out of town, your options are more limited. When you're in town, and you live in Baltimore, so there's plenty of places to get kosher coffee. So what do you need to go to Starbucks? When you're out of town, so you don't know where they are, I assume that's the rationale behind Rabbi Heinemann's chiluk. But obviously, if Mikra didn't, they weren't mutter, so it wouldn't be mutter out of town either. It's only because he thinks that Mikra din, they are mutter, but it's not so pashut. There's makom lahachmir, so if it's easy to be machmir, you should be machmir. Okay, you know, out of town is not, you know, getting coffee isn't also the end of the world, right? People can manage without coffee, even if you're tired, so you know, if you get a Coke. So there's, but that's basically what he says. So I printed out this this list from the CRC website, and I was just reading it. I didn't have a chance to read it yet, but I saw that they say a similar thing to me. When evaluating these issues, Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz acknowledged that there's a basis for leniency on many of the items sold at Starbucks stores, but directed the CRC to be true to the mission of a reliable kashrus agency which only recommends items that are free from all shilos, and not just ones that are acceptable b'diavad. So that being the case, they go ahead and they say what types of issues are okay. So what's okay at a full-service Starbucks store without problems? What's recommended? Almond milk, bottled beverages, with hechsher, coconut milk, cold milk, and soy milk.
That's fantastic.
So I don't know. But most people don't go to Starbucks to have milk. Okay. Then at the kiosks, so then you have a lot more room for leniency. Like you could have brewed coffee and cold brewed coffee and espressos using disposables, and iced coffee, and cappuccino or latte. So there's a lot of room for leniencies at the kiosk, not at the full service. What does that mean? Again, that's l'chatchila, that's the recommended practice. When people are mekel on their shayla, so you don't have to be mocha b'yadam. Like we said, there are some basis for leniencies. Like, as I said, the Star K says when you're out of town, you could be mekel. And the like. And again, the main reason to be machmir comes from the issue of the dishwashing. So, for example, why are they concerned with regular brewed coffee? Says, because brew basket may have been washed with non-kosher items. Although the brew basket is only used as a klisheni, the CRC recommends purchasing items that are free from all shilos. Right? So here we have really another double tzadlaka. One is, even if they're washed together, the pashtus says it doesn't make it aser b'diavad. In the dishwasher case, because it's iwoy kli. In the other one, so probably also irikli, that's not nisaka kiluach, but it's with soap and the like. So these are that's basically what the poskim say. When I once asked Rabbi Schechter about this, And he said, B'nai Torah should be machmir on the shayla. So, again, is it mutter? It's mutter. To get stam, it's mutter to get any type of brewed coffee, even at a full-service Starbucks, even though they say here it's not recommended. But is it recommended? There's makom lahachmir. But there's also makom lahakel, and there are times where it might be appropriate to follow the lenient psak, which is true, probably make a din. Yes?
So when you go to like a cafeteria and they have the Starbucks like thing in them, is that considered as if it was like a full Starbucks store? As in it's, like,
what do you mean the Starbucks things in them? Sorry.
The like circle, the brewery thing? It's like an urn, I don't know, it's like Starbucks coffee in like a...
You just take it out.
Yeah, and you take it out, but it's like in a section in a cafeteria. So I'm assuming they're washing it.
I don't know. You have to find out. It could be that that's totally okay. Because they don't, you know, I don't know how they wash those things. Do they wash them with everything, other things and the like? But again, I think this, it's important to keep in mind that this is begadir chumra. It's not a crazy chumra. But it's a chumra. It's not mikaradin. There's makom lahakel. Again, for the types of things that are, let's say, mutter in the kiosk-style stores, so mikaradin, they're probably mutter also at the full-service stores, but there's makom lahachmir. Yes, sorry. I can't hear. So... Yeah, so lattes have an additional issue over brewed coffee. The issue with lattes is the following. The metal steaming cup may have been washed with other non-kosher items. The beverage is okay if the barista agrees to merely heat it to 115 degrees or less. Now, what does that mean? I don't know exactly how they could figure that out.
They have a thermometer.
So that's the additional factor there. In other words, there we're dealing with a kli rishon mamish al haish. So 115 degrees is less than, they're assuming, is the shear of Yad Soled Espo. So they're willing to be mako. So yes, you're correct that lattes and cappuccinos are more problematic. They're still okay at the kiosk-style stores. Why? Because the dishwashing thing isn't an issue. The reason why they're more machmir about it, that lattes and cappuccinos are more of a problem, is because we're not just dealing with an issue of a kli sheni, we're dealing with an issue of a kli rishon. So I recommend that you read the guidelines. You don't need me to read them to you. You can get them online and the like. All right, Yael.
With Rabbi Schachter's answer that the Torah should be machmir.
Yeah,
that's what he said.
That's
what's
what he
the
said.
Definition of
B'nai
Torah?
That's a very good question. And the idea of B'nai Torah is a tricky thing. It's not a formal halachic category. And this is really a broader topic, which is one worth investigating at length. But we find many times in halacha where the halacha doesn't give a clear-cut answer. And there are variations. There are things like hamachmir tavo alav bracha, or bal nefesh yachmir. There are things like mutter b'makom hefseid, or mutter b'makom hefseid gadol, or mutter b'shasat chak, or the like. All these are variations of cases where probably me'ikar adin, it's really mutter, but there's makom lahachmir. Now what differentiates them is how much of a makom lahachmir is there. To understand the distinctions, one needs to really learn the sugya. And they vary. And chumrah, one chumrah is not like another chumrah. But some chumers we say, ha-machmir ha-reze hadyot. If you're machmir, it's silly, it's foolish. To give one example, in the laws of sukkahs, it says that if you're machmir and you stay in a sukkah, even if it's raining, you're foolish. But someone who's machmir to eat in a sukkah, even things that don't need to be eaten in a sukkah, like a glass of water, tava lav bracha. So there we have two chumras. What's the difference between the two? Could be the difference is because it's not even a kiyum mitzvah at all if it's raining. But if you look at the sources in a number of the makoros, it sounds like even if it is a kiyum mitzvah, we sometimes say a machmir harbeza adyot. So for example, the Bir Halacha quotes some as saying that to sit in the sukkah when it's miserable outside, so you might even if you get a kiyum mitzvah of yeshiva b'sukkah, but you're giving up on simchas yantif, right? Whereas going into the sukkah to drink a glass of water, there's very little cost to that. It's a beautiful thing, or for that matter, women eating and drinking in the sukkah. So every question has to be analyzed in its own right, and figuring out what's the reason to be machmir, A, and B, what's the cost? Meaning to say, a lot of times a chumrah comes with a kula. One example is what we said in terms of simchas yantif, but sometimes there are kulas in terms of bein adam l'chaveiro, like you're with someone else, and if you don't also get the coffee, they could be offended or whatever it is. Each question has to be analyzed on its own. So that's the first thing to consider. In this particular case, the way Rabbi Schechter viewed this issue of Starbucks, though, I don't know why he looked at it this way, but I'm going to present it to you the way he did, which is he understood it as, in terms of the issue of the dishwashing, where the first cycle was with soap, but the second cycle was without soap, even if it was in a Kli Rishon. If you follow the view of the Beis Yosef, which is the mainstream view, it would be Mutter. And if you follow the view of the Chazon Ish, who asks a very good question, it would be Aser. Again, I'm not sure why he looks at it this way, but that's the way he presents it. So that being the case, he thought Mikra did in the mainstream view. It was like the Beis Yosef, and he could be Mekel based off of No St. Tom of Gan. Chazon Ish makes a very good point. So it's not something you have to be Machmir about. So now, how do you define B'nai Torah? Right? So I don't think there's a specific definition, but I think it reflects a certain attitude. Somebody who is fully observant of the things that they need to do and tries to also stay away from shilos, not every shiloh. If you're machmir for every machlokas, then you won't be able to live life normally. But so that is what he meant. And Yerushalayim does demand a certain degree of hesitation, like to really be, when you're afraid of doing something usher, when it's not, even if it's, you could probably argue it's mutter, but it's not so clear. So there's a certain level of hesitation. But at the same time, many people aren't holding there. And if you're not even doing the basics yet, so you shouldn't be working on the chumras. Somebody is still not fully observant in various areas of halacha. So where should they be working? They shouldn't be working on things that are really mutter mikra din. They should be working on the basics. And the reality is, and this is something that's very important to keep in mind, which is that we're all of limited resources and strength and the like. And when you're machmir about one thing, especially if it's something that's hard for you, so there's a danger. It can build resentment and the like. Somebody who loves their Starbucks. So if you tell her she should be machmir and not buy her coffee from the full-service Starbucks store, So then that's a big sacrifice for her. And it's not necessarily the sacrifice, the place where she should be sacrificing. Maybe there are much more basic issues in her life which she should be working on first. But if she feels like she's sacrificing with the Starbucks, then she's not going to do those. And so person, whenever we're dealing with something that is not usher, but again, in the realm of chumrah, not usher nekradin, so you have to think very carefully if this is worth it to be machmir on. And if you're too machmir, then oftentimes the consequences could be negative. Al ti tzadik harbe is a real thing. Everybody has to figure out where it makes sense for them to work and to work on those areas. And so, you know, if a person isn't so zahir, and going back to our discussion earlier and the laws of Lashon Hara, so then that's a lot more chamor. It doesn't make sense for them to be working on Starbucks if that's mikra adin mutter, when they should be working on Lashon Hara, which is really a very chamor iser. So, again, over here, where, again, many of these Starbucks drinks are really mutter mikra adin, that's what I think Rabbi Shachter was getting at. You have to be holding there to make sense for you to be machmir. And a person has to know themselves to be able to answer that question. What is it going to make me feel like if I can't have my Starbucks? And what's going to be the expense of that? All right, I guess we're not going to get back to the parsha. So, we'll stop here. And Bez Hashem, we'll pick up with some parsha and maybe some questions next week.